This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehius Wahib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
And so, my friends, it is with humility, determination, and boundless confidence in America's promise that I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
That's Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton speaking last night at the Democratic Party National Convention in Philadelphia. Details coming up. Also, a Save the Children report says thousands of unaccompanied migrant children are criminally exploited when they arrive in Europe. And a UN humanitarian official says Boko Haram is guilty of some of the most heinous, barbaric, and unconscionable violence in Nigeria. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is urging voters not to give in to the politics of fear. She vowed to unite the country and move it forward if elected in November. Mrs. Clinton formally accepted the Democratic Party's nomination at its national convention in Philadelphia. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more.
On the final night of the Democratic National Convention, delegates were in a mood to celebrate and to make history. Chelsea Clinton, daughter of the 42nd president, introduced her mother, who hopes to become the 45th.
I'm voting for a fighter who never, ever gives up, and who believes that we can always do better when we come together and we work together.
And in a city made famous by America's founding fathers, Hillary Clinton stepped into the spotlight to make some history of her own as the first woman presidential nominee of a major political party.
And so, my friends, it is with humility, determination, and boundless confidence in America's promise that I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
In a preview of the tough campaign to come, Clinton took steady aim at the man she'll run against in November, Republican Donald Trump.
Imagine him in the Oval Office facing a real crisis. A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons.
Clinton vowed to focus on creating jobs and growing the economy, and she pledged to work for national unity if elected in November.
So let's be stronger together, my fellow Americans. Let's look to the future with courage and confidence. Let's build a better tomorrow for our beloved children and our beloved country. And when we do, America will be greater than ever. Thank you, and may God bless you.
Afterward, Clinton was joined on stage by her husband, Bill, and daughter, as well as her vice presidential running mate, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. The focus on the Democratic convention did not keep Republican Donald Trump off the campaign trail. Trump offered himself as an agent of change at a rally in Iowa.
We can't go for another 4 years of Obama because that's basically what crooked Hillary Clinton is. We can't go for another 4 years of Obama.
With both party conventions now over, the focus is on two presidential candidates with high negative ratings from voters, says veteran analyst Gerald Seib.
It may be a very messy one, maybe an ugly one, maybe a not nice one. I mean, I think a lot of this campaign, whether people like it or not, and I don't like it, is going to be about convincing voters to vote against the other person, not for this person. And that inevitably produces a very ugly campaign.
Trump got a boost in the polls after the Republican convention in Cleveland last week. And now Clinton and the Democrats are hoping for a bump of their own as they shift into general election mode for November. Jim Malone, VOA News, at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
The Italian branch of Save the Children says thousands of unaccompanied migrant children face criminal exploitation when they arrive in Europe. About 10,000 have arrived in Italy so far this year, far more than last year. Save the Children has released a new report called Invisible Little Slaves. Reporter Josephine McKenna has a copy of the report. From Rome, she tells VOA's Jody Capua about the findings.
This is a very disturbing report released today by Save the Children, saying that the number of unaccompanied children fleeing to Italy and Europe has doubled since 2015. Girls as young as 13 years old are being forced into prostitution. Children are being forced to work for years to repay their debt to people smugglers, and that can be as high as 50,000 euros. There are also reports of voodoo rituals and threats against families used to trap children in these cycles of abuse. And that might mean prostitution, it might mean exploitation in the workforce, but there's a great deal of concern here from Save the Children about these vulnerable children that are arriving usually by sea. And we've seen more than 10,000 unaccompanied children arrive in Italy between January and June just this year.
Does the report talk about why these kids feel they just can't simply escape into Italy?
Well, the charity found that girls from countries like Nigeria, young teenagers as young as 13, are being tricked into believing that they will secure good jobs like babysitting or waitressing or hairdressing. And they're often entrapped by their own teachers or boyfriends. And then they're forced into prostitution once they arrive and subjected to physical, sexual and emotional violence that often keeps them entrapped. And the girls are often afraid to report the abuse. They're often constrained so that they can't report any kind of abuse. And the report also said there's evidence that girls contract sexually transmitted diseases or become pregnant and are often forced to have an abortion or are blackmailed with threats against their babies to ensure that they don't try to escape.
Tell us about the threats being made through voodoo.
Well, to ensure the girls, especially those from Nigeria, repay these massive debts, traffickers can threaten their families with violence and in some cases subject them to voodoo rituals where they're manipulated into believing that if they try to leave, they will be struck down by madness or even death. One girl from Nigeria who was 17 when her boyfriend convinced her to make the journey to Italy said she had no idea when she arrived she would have to become a sex worker. And one day she called her boyfriend's sister who told her that she had to give the family 50,000 euros to pay for that trip. And she found out in the meantime that her aunt in Nigeria had been threatened, her younger sister had been beaten, and they had been threatened with voodoo, and she was terribly afraid. So that gives you some idea of the fear and the threats of violence and the violence that people are suffering on both continents, which is really quite extreme.
What about the exploitation that young boys are facing when they're migrants?
While the majority of girls are forced into the sex trade, boys from countries like Egypt are often subjected to child labour and forced into criminal activity like theft and drug dealing to repay their debts. And traffickers use social networks like Facebook to lure the boys with the promise of a better life in Europe and the chance to help lift their families out of poverty. The report said that Egyptian boys in Rome are often forced to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, washing cars, but earning only around 2 euros an hour. Then they suffer problems actually getting paid. So it's not just about sexual abuse, it's about abuse in the workplace and, of course, this threat of violence and exploitation that is so dramatic, especially for young people.
Did Save the Children make any recommendations?
Save the Children says that the Italian government has already taken steps to better protect victims from child trafficking, but it's calling for a counter-trafficking plan to be put in place as quickly as possible, urging authorities to wake up to the crisis and do more to protect children in danger.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. Turkey is giving sanctuary to the largest number of Syrian refugees, almost 2.7 million. But the recent failed coup in Turkey could further complicate their lives. Nuria Tesson has the story from Istanbul.
In March this year, Turkey signed a deal with the European Union to stop refugees from crossing its western border to enter Europe via Greece. But the deal is under pressure on several fronts since it took effect last April. Many say it's working in slow motion and even about to unravel, with Turkey demanding visa liberalization for its citizens. The EU is hesitant to act due to the ongoing crackdown on journalists and academics in Turkey. Add to this the recent failed coup, leaving many Syrians wondering what the political fallout will mean for them and what the future holds for the agreement. Mohammed Daoud is a 38-year-old human resources manager who fled the war in Syria for Lebanon. However, with hostility towards the Syrian migrants growing, he left a year and a half ago for Turkey. So far, he has not been able to find a job.
I don't work. I came to work here. I told him I can work, I can help without money, because I started to feel that I'm frozen here. I need my brain to work. I started to lose my skills.
President Erdogan has promoted an open-door policy for Syrians fleeing more than 5 years of civil war in their country. In Turkey, they have guest status, but last July, Erdogan announced plans to grant them citizenship. Critics say he's just trying to grab more votes. With the current political instability, many are turning their eyes to the Syrians as enemies instead of guests. After the recent coup attempt, the Turks are more worried about the political crackdown than about international agreements. More than 60,000 people have been sacked and more than 9,000 detained. Europe demands that Turkey respect the rule of law. This could lead the EU to reconsider the agreement. Syrians, meanwhile, generally trust Erdogan. Others, like Mohammed, think all refugees want is a safe place to call home, but they get trapped in Turkish politics.
Here they are friendly with us as a people. They are really friendly. But the government using the Syrian problem and the Syrian case like a card for their benefits.
For now, it remains unclear how the post-coup actions of the government will impact Syrian refugees who live in Turkey. For Voice of America, I'm Nuria Tesson in Istanbul.
Eighteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Former Chadian dictator Hissène Habré has been ordered to pay more than $30,000 to each surviving victim who suffered war crimes and crimes against humanity under his rule. Habré is currently serving a life sentence following his conviction in a special Senegalese court earlier this year. The court today awarded the money to thousands of survivors of rape, sexual slavery, torture, and arbitrary detention, and to each mistreated former prisoner of war. In Nigeria, Boko Haram militants have attacked a UN humanitarian convoy yesterday with rockets and gunfire. Several civilians were injured, including workers from UNICEF and the International Organization for Migration. The Nigerian military said two soldiers providing an armed escort were also injured. The attack occurred as the convoy passed near the Sambisa forest, where Boko Haram insurgents are known to have clandestine camps. The convoy is taking aid to the town of Bama and some of the nearly 3 million displaced people suffering food shortages in Nigeria's three northeast states. UN Humanitarian Chief Stephen O'Brien has told the UN Security Council that Boko Haram is guilty of some of the most heinous, barbaric, and unconscionable violence in Nigeria. He says more than 9 million people in the Lake Chad Basin need help to survive violence and climate change. Two UN agencies warn that protracted conflicts in 17 countries have pushed more than 56 million people into severe insecurity. The World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization say Yemen is at the top of the list with 14 million people, or half the population, in a state of hunger crisis. Syria has nearly 9 million people in the same situation. The UN agencies say nearly 5 million people in South Sudan are in urgent need of food and livelihood assistance. The WFP and the FAO have rated countries on a scale of 1 to 5 according to the severity of food shortages. 5 would be the most severe, meaning a catastrophe or possible famine. WFP Senior East Africa spokesperson Chalice McDonough spoke to VOA's William Eagle about the cycle of conflict and food insecurity.
It is a vicious cycle because conflict is one of the leading causes of hunger in the world, but hunger can also contribute to violence. It can be something, you know, through which, you know, political grievances are expressed. And so you have a lot of ways in which conflict undermines food security. And those are, I think, relatively clear, and we can see them very starkly in places like South Sudan or the Central African Republic, because people, because of conflict, people are displaced, are not able to grow crops or tend their livestock. It undermines people's ability to provide for their families. But it can also then, when people are hungry, create or contribute to instability, a lack of security, a breakdown of law and order, because people are taking, particularly armed actors will respond to hunger in a sometimes extreme fashion.
The FAO and the WFP, the World Food Program, have categorized several countries according to what's called the IPC scale, the Integrated Food Security Classification Phase scale. And many countries are on the extreme with regard to hunger. There are numbers 3 and 4. How close are we to famine?
3 and 4 are not actually the worst on that scale. There is actually a phase 5, which is famine. There are very specific kind of technical criteria that go into measuring and declaring a famine. And right now, as I speak in the world, there is not actual famine conditions occurring in any of those 17 countries, but there are a number of them that have come very close or are very close now. The situation in Yemen and in South Sudan, for example, are extremely troubling, and there are definitely populations that have people who have been pushed right to the brink. And every scale that you go higher, you have a larger and larger percentage of the population who can't meet their needs. And you see malnutrition rates rising. So and these things are all connected. So the more people have trouble being able to get what they need to eat, the higher the malnutrition rates are, and then people become more vulnerable to disease. And a disease outbreak actually can be what pushes you from phase 4 into, you know, an emergency phase, into that catastrophe, phase 5 famine.
As the levels of hardship increase, is there any mechanism that kicks in within the international community that calls upon the international community to take action when a country reaches a certain level, a certain severity of hunger?
The declaration of famine or even of a phase 3 or phase 4 level crisis does not have a political trigger. It's an early warning. And so this system is aimed at letting us say, this is the place where we have a problem and we need to act now to keep it from getting worse. You know, I mean, it alerts us in the humanitarian community, and we as a humanitarian agency would be remiss if we did not respond to it, but we also need response from the international community. You know, I was here in East Africa working on the last famine that was declared in the world, which was in southern Somalia. And that declaration of famine did trigger a response in the international community, but that response needed to come earlier. And so this system is aimed at helping us keep from getting to phase five. We have to respond when we're looking at a serious situation in phase three and phase four, both in terms of addressing the conflict in these cases that led to it, as well as the hunger crisis that that conflict has created or worsened.
That was World Food Program spokesperson Chalice McDonough from Nairobi. She spoke with VOA's William Eagle. Officials in Cameroon have suspended 10 newspaper and broadcast journalists for 3 months. The country's Communication Council accuses the journalists of unprofessional conduct, but the media professionals say they were suspended because they criticized the government. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the capital, Yaoundé.
Joseph Janvier René Mvoto Obuno, Vice President of Cameroon's National Communication Council, or NCC, said the 10 journalists were suspended for making unsubstantiated claims capable of tarnishing the image and integrity of some senior state functionaries. He said newspapers, radio stations and TV stations that employ the journalists must make sure the suspensions are enforced. He says he has instructed those concerned to make sure they apply the sanctions, without which administrative authorities and the police will be asked to arrest them or seal their media organs. Among the senior state officials who petitioned the NCC for the sanctions were two allies of President Paul Biya, Martin Belinga Ebutu, Director of Cabinet for the President, and Esimi Menye, former Minister of Finance. The suspended journalists say they are being silenced for criticizing Biya over alleged corruption, poor governance, and his 34-year stay in power. The NCC is unpopular among Cameroonian journalists who see it as an arm of the state. President Biya created the council and also appoints people to head it. Journalists object to that process, saying any regulatory organ should be run by fellow journalists and managed independently. The sanctions come 4 months after the NCC suspended journalists from 8 newspapers and a TV station. Last year, Reporters Without Borders said the very high number of summonses and suspensions dished out was an indication the NCC has taken a tougher line towards Cameroon's media. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News. Yaoundé.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who is going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.